There's one boss, essentially, for all, almost all executive branch employees. You know, orders can come down. Not so on Capitol Hill. Every Senate office, every, you know, office of a House member, it's like 535 fiefdoms. And they all get to make decisions about how they're going to do what they're going to do. So you're seeing that play out in this response. And frankly, like, it's just this kind of just uncoordinated, and everybody gets to decide their own thing. It just doesn't seem to fit the bill based on the facts and the reality of this virus that's almost certainly circulating in the community. So we are seeing institutionally Congress acting in the way almost that it always has, which is, you know, members are their own bosses and they get to do what they want.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 10th, 2020. It's actually the Lawfare Podcast in exile because we have been evicted from the Jungle Studio because of coronavirus concerns. We are recording remotely, and it is a good day to discuss the congressional response to coronavirus. And that is why Margaret Taylor is joining me, Lawfare's congressional guru. We're going to talk about what legislation Congress has passed, what legislation Congress and the Trump administration are considering in relation to the virus. And we are also going to talk about how Congress has responded institutionally, why there are still people giving tours of the Capitol to groups of small children who can cough on them and whom they can cough on. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 519, Congress and Corona. So, Margaret, I bet you didn't think when you came to Lawfare a year ago that we'd be having a conversation about congressional response to pandemic disease.
You know, I did not anticipate that specifically, but one thing I learned working up on Capitol Hill for 5.5 years is that for all the planning you might do at the beginning of a Congress about all the things your member's going to get done and everything that's going to happen, there's always something like this that comes along that is a big deal that comes out of nowhere and ends up, you know, eating up a bunch of time and just being something that has to be dealt with. So in that respect, it's not that surprising.
Yeah, I mean, so what are the examples? For me, when I went to the Washington Post as a young editorial writer, you know, I had all these conversations with Meg Greenfield, who was then the editorial page editor, about all these high-minded things we were going to work on. And then I got there in the November of 1997, and I guess January of 1998, it was all Monica Lewinsky all the time for the next 2 years. Prior to coronavirus, what's the example of that for you on the Hill that, you know, whatever you thought you were going to be working on, it turned out, you know, God had a different plan?
I guess the one thing I would point to is Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Although, you know, there was this inkling that it was going on, there was reporting about it in 2016. And actually, we were kind of planning when I was up on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, planning to do some legislation to address that issue. It became just such a big deal. Trump was elected, obviously, and that became a project that we worked on from, you know, the beginning of 2017 all the way through that spring and summer until the CATSA legislation, the sanctions legislation related to Russia sanctions, was passed and then reluctantly signed by the president. So that was a big deal. And it took up a lot of time, and we were really focused on it. And, you know, a lot of the things that we wanted to do didn't get as much attention, I think, as they would have.
All right. So we're going to leave aside the whole issue of the quality of the administration's performance in response to this crisis, and really focus for purposes of this conversation on congressional response. So let's start by having you give us an overview of what Congress has done so far and what the focus of legislative efforts to date have been.
Yeah, so obviously a lot of energy up on Capitol Hill on this issue. The states are very concerned. Officials in the states are reaching to their representatives in Congress. Constituents are reaching out. Constituents are concerned. So lots of energy around this issue in Congress. And that takes a few different forms. The Congress passed and the president signed $8.3 billion for the federal response last week, including, you know, to fund research to develop a vaccine. So to me, that was sort of like the first wave of legislative effort to address sort of the health issues themselves. And it looks like now there's going to be sort of a second wave. And actually just today, we're recording today is Tuesday. President Trump went up to Capitol Hill, visited with Senate Republicans, and, you know, said he was going to be describing some very major, very dramatic proposals that he thinks could get through Congress swiftly. It's not a lot of detail yet on what that is, but it would seem to include a payroll tax holiday through the November election. That's what some reporting from Bloomberg has been showing. And so this is the second wave of legislative effort. Seems to be more focused on the economic fallout from coronavirus and, you know, addressing the, you know, bloodbath that is the stock market and also impacts on everyday people, everyday workers. There's a contrasting view, or maybe not contrasting, a different vision, I'd say, coming from Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. She is describing a package of legislation that would feature, you know, free testing for those showing coronavirus symptoms, expanded unemployment insurance for those laid off by the economic effects of the virus, paid sick leave for quarantine workers or parents of kids whose schools are closed as a result of the epidemic, an expansion of food stamps to ensure that kids don't go hungry because of school closures. So this is sort of like the legislative discussion of the moment right now.
It kind of maps on sort of crudely to a broader debate between Democrats and Republicans, right? You know, Republicans look at the situation and see a kind of market impact, and their instincts are tax cuts and, you know, kind of market stabilization. And Democrats look at the situation and see, you know, large numbers of people for whom they would want to provide assistance anyway in greater need of that assistance. And so they kind of instinctively want to do the sort of thing that they would want to do anyway as well. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is fair. Although I would just point out, and this is commonly known, there are a number of Republican, at least one Republican Senator, Ted Cruz, and a few congressmen who have had personal exposure to people who have the coronavirus. And so I do wonder sort of going forward if there might be a little bit more convergence on these views in light of how, you know, this is going to impact people's constituents and it's impacting the members themselves. There's several members who are in self-quarantine. So I do wonder, one thing that's really interesting that I saw today being reported was that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell basically, you know, said, he says, Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin is going to have, you know, quote, ball control, unquote, for the Trump administration on this new legislative package, and that he's going to negotiate directly, meaning the Trump administration will negotiate directly with Nancy Pelosi on this economic package. And the Senate Republicans are going to sort of defer to that process and see if that process produces a deal and then seemingly, you know, go along with it. So it's just interesting to me, you pointed to these like different visions. It does seem like Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans are going to sort of let the Trump administration and the House Democrats sort of fight it out and see what they can come to in terms of compromise.
Right. So let's talk about what has emerged as Congress has examined these things in terms of the president's and the country's readiness. Last week, there was some testimony suggesting that we were pretty well positioned for whatever was going to happen. This week, it seems a little less certain in that regard. How illuminating have these hearings been that Congress has been holding?
So there've definitely been a lot of them. There were at least two last week. There's three more coming up this week. And I would just note for our listeners that we are trying to write up summaries of most of these hearings so that people who don't have time to listen to a whole long hearing can sort of, you know, 10 minutes read sort of what's going on in one of these coronavirus hearings. So that's on the Lawfare website, and I encourage everyone to take a look. One of the hearings from last week, which featured testimony from a guy named Robert Kadlec, who is an assistant secretary at Health and Human Services. And he sort of took the part of the hearing that was talking about, you know, America's healthcare, you know, system's preparedness to respond to this type of thing. And in his prepared remarks, he was actually pretty optimistic about that, you know, there's something called the Hospital Preparedness Program, which came into being after 9/11. And it was specifically designed to improve the capacity of hospitals around the country to deal with disasters and influxes of patients. His testimony talks about, you know, the program's grants. With the program's grants, states have been able to purchase equipment and supplies to enhance their hospitals' emergency medical surge capacities. So, you know, sort of a rosy picture there. And yet, just today, the CDC director, Redfield, basically was expressing concern that hospitals don't have the right kinds of equipment to deal with respiratory illness, which is a big part of coronavirus, as it's been reported from China and elsewhere. And so, you know, it's just sort of interesting to see that message be changed over time as the reality sort of begins to set in about, you know, where the holes are, where the gaps are. And in this vein, I would just note that there's a guy named Tom Bossert, who was Trump's pandemic advisor before being, you know, ousted from the National Security Council in 2018 and his position eliminated, essentially. And he said today, he told Ken Delanian at NBC that, quote, "We are 10 days from the hospitals getting creamed," unquote. Which was a really striking statement, I thought. So, you know, you're seeing these issues being raised, then there's a little more reality gets injected. And then, you know, hearing a statement like that is actually, you know, a little bit scary. And when you combine it with some reporting coming out of Northern Italy about basically hospitals getting creamed and not having beds for people who are really sick, not being able to treat people who, you know, might be treatable, but they just don't have the capacity to do it. You know, I think members are really starting to think about the reality of what's going to happen or what could happen with hospitals here in the United States.
So if you're a congressional staffer or a member, unlike, you know, a CDC official or, you know, somebody who's in an immediate sense has executive responsibility, how do you think about your role in something like this? Is it basically to vote to spend money and to enable the people who are actually doing the work, you know, kind of write them a blank or semi-blank check, and, you know, that's kind of what you can do? Or is there a kind of more granular policy response for members and their staffs that are productive in real time rather than in, okay, when we're done with this, we'll think about what the next time looks like? But how do you think about your role as a member or a congressional staffer in the middle of a crisis like this?
So I think the first thing to say is that, you know, what is going on in the states or in the district is going to be the thing that is basically most important to members. And they are going to be, they are hearing from people in the state all the time. You know, for example, at one of these hearings, Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire, you know, she said in the hearing, public health officials in New Hampshire tried to order additional personal protective equipment. That's, you know, basically sort of clothing and goggles and stuff that protect people in hospitals from actually getting the illness when they're treating patients. They were told it was on back order until May. She's worried that the Strategic National Stockpile, a backup inventory of these federally maintained medical supplies reserved for these public health emergency, won't have enough supplies to meet states' needs. So that's the first thing. They're trying to get answers that they can take back to officials in their states and their constituents. And that's a lot of that now is going to be oversight, right? So they're trying to, you know, get the executive branch, the answers out of the executive branch, get the executive branch, you know, headed in the right direction so that there can be solutions and answers. So I would say, no, it's not a question of just writing a blank check, particularly with the distrust, I'd say, there is associated now with this administration and how the Trump administration has been handling this crisis. I think they are going to look to be quite involved with the direction of the efforts by the federal government so that they can make sure, you know, their states and their constituents are going to be, you know, their needs are going to be addressed. So I think we will see it be quite granular and quite contentious. That isn't to say they won't reach a deal. I think they will reach a deal as between, you know, the Trump administration and Congress, in particular, you know, Democrats in the House, because everyone will want that. Like their incentive is to come to a deal that works for everyone. That's not always true on legislation. Sometimes there's an incentive to keep fighting on something, but not on this. This is such a big deal. Members will want to be involved. They want to be seen to be involved. They're concerned about what's going on in the Trump administration. So I think you'll see continue to see a lot of energy and really no blank checks.
All right. I want to ask you an incredibly unpolitically correct question that I would normally not ask, but the DC Circuit has now forced me to ask this question. So I want to emphasize that I'm doing it under protest. The DC Circuit says last week in the McGahn case that, you know, Congress has all these tools available to it. And if it wants to force Don McGahn to testify, it shouldn't come whining to the courts in the form of a suit like it did. It should rather, you know, hold up something that the president really cares about and condition it on compliance with the subpoena that Don McGahn received from the House Judiciary Committee. Well, you and I were speculating last week on the Lawfare podcast, you know, there really isn't anything the president cares about that much or wants from Congress. Well, now there is. So should Nancy Pelosi condition further as part of this negotiation, should she build in as part of it, you want these things from us, your payroll tax stuff, your payroll tax holiday, your relief for whatever, Don McGahn's got to show up and testify? Or is that just so politically radioactive a thing to do when people are quite literally dying that it is the kind of solution that only the DC Circuit could love?
To ask your question is to answer it. It's so obvious to me that is, you know, the latter proposal, you know, it's just not going to work politically. Nancy Pelosi, nobody
else. Call it the Tom Griffith bill.
Right. Yeah. That will not translate well, I think, to, you know, constituents in the district. They will not understand why that is happening. All they will understand is that my, you know, congressman or woman or senator is blocking, you know, legislation that's going to help me through this pandemic.
Grandma's life. And, right. And they're holding it up for political considerations, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, not going to happen.
So it's a non-starter?
That's a non-starter. Absolute non-starter.
But it is, to go back to our conversation of last week about the McGahn case, it is exactly what the DC Circuit was saying, right?
I'd say not exactly, because I think what the DC Circuit had in mind seemed like much more mundane types of things. The DC Circuit references, you know, confirmations. It references sort of annual appropriations process, the sort of more mundane work of the Congress and the cooperation that goes on or is supposed to go on between the Congress and the president. So which as you and I have discussed, I don't think is sort of where the leverage is with this administration, with, you know, a president who prefers acting officials to confirmed officials, who, you know, would love to sort of paint Nancy Pelosi as obstinate in the annual appropriations process for demanding things. So I think it's a little bit, they don't say, you know, if there's a pandemic or if there's a 9/11 style attack, that's the moment to vindicate or enforce congressional subpoenas. But I mean, your point is well taken, and it seems to me it points out the difficulty and maybe impracticality of the circuit court's decision in thinking that this will just work the way they've envisioned it. The reality is, you know, what we're seeing now, which is this is must-pass legislation in the face of an epidemic, basically. And these political, what the court is thinking of as these political tools just don't play out in reality the way I think judges might think of them in the abstract.
I think that Pelosi should attach all kinds of riders to it, give the president what he wants, but require disclosures of tax returns, require production of all the contested documents, and just force the president to veto all the things that he actually wants.
Well, you know, I suppose we'll see. I suspect that will not be the approach that is taken.
I suspect, but you're right. All right, let's talk about Congress's other institutional response. The last I checked, the public still had access to the Capitol building, where they are free to go and breathe on members and cough on them. Members who had been exposed to people with the virus were giving tours of the building to children, which seems ill-advised. And staff and members do not seem to be telecommuting, much less holding hearings by teleconference or doing some of the things that, frankly, universities major universities are starting to do. So here's my question: is Nancy Pelosi being too conservative about coronavirus in her role, not as a legislator, but in her role as, and for that matter, Mitch McConnell as well, as they're the kind of co-directors of a large organization that, you know, sucks in large numbers of people and spits them out to fan out all over the country and spread disease? Should they be doing more in their own institutional management role to prevent people from coming into the facility?
So personally, I think the answer to that question is yes, they should be doing more. You know, Congress and its leaders, they see Congress, they see themselves as, you know, they're the representatives of the people. They should be accessible to the public. You know, people should be able to come in. It's not really a building that belongs to the members. It belongs to Americans. So there's definitely this underlying ethos of openness with Capitol Hill and Congress. And that's all fine and good until you have a situation like this, which is, you know, communicable person to person. You know, there's, as you said, lots of institutions are trying to do this social distancing. But it seems to me that Capitol Hill, both on the House side and the Senate side, they're a little bit behind the curve on the measures that really should be taken in order to mitigate the spread of disease. And just to be clear, I'm a lawyer. I'm not a medical professional. So it's just my view. I do understand from the reporting and from statements by members that they are consulting with experts about what to do. So the attending physician of the Capitol is someone they're consulting with. They're consulting with CDC officials about these issues. And, you know, I'm not going to blame them for relying on expert advice, but it does seem to me that there isn't quite enough control. So, you know, for example, as you referenced, Representative Louie Gohmert from Texas, you know, even though he reportedly had been exposed to someone who had the coronavirus at the Conservative Political Action Committee meeting, he, you know, consulted his own physician, and that physician said, "Oh, well, just, you know, wash your hands," or something along those lines, and you're fine. And he is still going to work, and he's, as you said, leading tours of the Capitol, including with children. And so
work may be a generous description to what he goes to when he shows up at the Capitol.
Well, true. That could be said of many up on Capitol Hill, presumably. But contrast that with what other members are doing, which seems more responsible. So, for example, Senator Ted Cruz, also exposed at this conservative conference last week, he made the decision to self-quarantine, and he's tweeting about it. There's a couple of other congressmen who are, and one congresswoman who are doing the same thing. And so it just seems to me this idea that, well, all the members just get to just sort of decide what they do. And, you know, the public is still going to be welcomed into the Capitol. You know, I think it's behind the curb, in particular, when we think about these warnings about, you know, the sort of tsunami of patients that other countries have seen that really put stress on the hospitals and on the health system. So I would like for there to be a little bit more of a lockdown going on on Capitol Hill. And that leadership really needs to come from the top.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I'm perplexed by the aggregate guidance that, you know, for God's sake, don't get on a cruise ship. Think twice before you get on a long haul flight. Don't go somewhere with large crowds, except the Capitol. Right?
That just doesn't make sense.
It seems just not to make sense. And I can kind of understand Pelosi and McConnell's view that Congress has business to do. It still needs to operate, but I'm not sure why it needs to operate in this very public, you know, we're the people's house, anybody can just walk in off the street kind of way. It does seem like when you're dealing with a highly transmissible, lethal virus, there's something to be said for, you know, just as certain other facilities like basketball games maybe shouldn't be happening in large arenas right now, or classes at certain universities, I'm not sure why a congressional hearing needs to be done not by teleconference, to be perfectly frank.
Well, one impediment to that is that the House rules actually require the presence of House members when, you know, if they're going to be at a hearing, if they're going to be counted as being at a hearing, that they physically be there. If they're going to count for quorum purposes, they'd physically be there to vote. They also have to physically be there, even though there is electronic voting from, you know, various machines, they still have to physically be there. And that's such a feature of the House rules. There is actually a proposal out there from Representative Eric Swalwell, California. He actually has a bipartisan piece of legislation he has introduced with Rick Crawford, as a Republican from Arkansas. And basically, it's just a House resolution, but it would essentially change the House rules such that lawmakers could attend hearings sort of via teleconference, and that would count for quorum purposes. They could also vote on just a limited type number of votes, like a type of vote called a suspension motion vote, which is essentially a vote to suspend the rules to take up a non-controversial item. So it's in my view, just, you know, it's a modest little resolution, a modest change to the rules that could be useful under these current circumstances, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest around this. Representative Swalwell has introduced this. Actually, the first time he introduced it was in 2013, but it's never garnered a lot of interest. It's seen, I think, by institutionalists as, you know, a slippery slope to, you know, all of a sudden the House of Representatives, or, you know, the same is true in the Senate, you know, no longer being a deliberative body. It's just a place where, you know, the members sit in their district and push a button on votes, and it's not a place where people come together and debate and discuss. So there is sort of a whole controversy and line of thinking around this question of remote attendance and remote voting in the Congress. Kind of an interesting set of issues.
Pardon me while I gag. The idea that after watching the Senate trial, that there's anything like deliberation that takes place in Congress as a result of member presence seems to me faintly laughable. But in any event, I won't go on a rant about that subject now, although I reserve the right to later. it seems to me there's a different question with respect to congressional staff, because at least as I understand it, there's no rule that requires staff to be there, or that members to be there for any purpose other than quorum and voting. Is that right?
That's right. And actually, a number of members' offices have already instituted telework for their staff. So again, it's it's you're seeing different offices make different decisions about how to handle this. Some of them are saying, okay, yeah, staff are going to telework. We're going to, you know, really be aggressive about it. And others are just not. And it's interesting to see, and I'm not surprised because unlike the executive branch, right, where you have a president, it's, you know, the unitary executive branch, there's one boss essentially for all, almost all executive branch employees, you know, orders can come down. Not so on Capitol Hill. Every Senate office, every, you know, office of a House member, it's like 535 fiefdoms. And they all get to make decisions about how they're going to do what they're going to do. So you're seeing that play out in this response. And frankly, like it's just this kind of just uncoordinated and everybody gets to decide their own thing. It just doesn't seem to fit the bill based on the facts and the reality of this virus that's almost certainly circulating in the community. So anyway, that's my personal view. but we are seeing, you know, institutionally Congress acting in the way almost that it always has, which is, you know, members are their own bosses and they get to do what they want.
And what about on the Senate side? So we've talked a little bit about Pelosi's response. You had mentioned before that McConnell's legislative posture seems to be whatever Pelosi and the president can work out, he'll muscle through the Senate, which I understand as a legislative posture. But what about as an institutional posture? It seems to me he's got a little bit of a difficult line to walk because as a policy matter, he, of course, wants to back the president. But as the administration's efforts in this are not shrouding themselves in glory, he does seem like he risks looking very weak in the oversight department to the extent that the Senate, you know, is kind of busily talking about Burisma and Joe Biden while people are dying in American cities.
I actually don't think, I guess it is sort of a risk for him, but honestly, you know, my honest view is that after the impeachment, the impeachment trial and how it ended, I think really showed that President Trump has really consolidated his influence and control over Senate Republicans. And so even in these circumstances, it's not clear to me that if I'm Mitch McConnell or a Senate Republican, that being seen to be criticizing President Trump or, you know, the administration on their efforts, it's not clear to me that that's going to be politically useful for them. So, but, you know, I mean, they are holding hearings in the Senate. You know, there is serious work being done, bipartisan work. One of the hearings from last week was in the Senate. And Senator Ron Johnson, who's a Republican from Wisconsin, you know, in this hearing, he did say, you know, this is a long-term project of making sure that America's health infrastructure is up to snuff. You know, we should think of this as like a security investment. You know, one of the witnesses in that hearing said, you know, we spend so much money on aircraft carriers, but the health of our health systems is we should think of it in the same way. And so it's not that people aren't taking it seriously. They are. But I at the same time, I don't see Senate Republicans coming out openly and criticizing this administration. They're just not going to do that.
So as you look forward over the next couple weeks, it seems to me like what you're expecting is day-to-day oversight, a second round of legislation that will be negotiated between the House and the White House, and then institutional sort of social distancing only to the extent that circumstances really force it. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. And it may be the case that, you know, something happens and all of a sudden, you know, like a light switches on and, you know, we will close the Capitol. There will be stricter measures, but we're not there yet. I mean, I have to say, in particular on the Senate side, some of the things that the Senate Republicans were saying. So, for example, John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, you know, said, you know, reporters were asking him, so what about the security in the Capitol? And he said, you're very safe. Just do what your mother told you to do. Wash your hands. And that just seems, you know, like not a tenable response. So what I'm looking for is, I hope those types of responses, which I think are a little bit behind the curve, will change and they'll start to get a little bit more serious. But bottom line, yes, what you described, I that's how I see this moving forward for now.
We're going to leave it there. Margaret Taylor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. This is the first of a series that we're going to be doing in which all of our recording is going to be remote. So please do forgive inevitable audio quality disruption that might arise. We hope you will share this material on social media anyway. Pin it on Pinterest, share it on Facebook, tweet it, and upvote it on Reddit or whatever the heck you do on Reddit. We also hope you will give us that 5-star rating on whatever podcast distribution service you use. We hope you will buy Lawfare swag from thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this episode was Jacob Schultz. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the uninfected by coronavirus, Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.